Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis and Chuck Thurston. Good morning, guys.
Hey, Paula.
Good morning, Paula and Chuck.
Good morning.
Good morning, guys.
So I just posted the wonderful lyrics of In My Soul by Rabia al-Basri. Sung by Annie Zonneveld, an imam, a Muslim, a female Muslim imam. Yeah. So thank you to her for allowing us to use her beautiful song, and to Rubia for penning those beautiful words. And we are here today to continue our study on the family, which from the Urantia book is, let's see, it's paper 84, Marriage and Family Life. And we're on section 2, the mother family. And that'll be an interesting study. And right before we opened up, Andre and I were both sharing our experience with our first marriage. Which, you know, and I think it's important as we discuss what the Urantia book talks about, you know, in terms of the ideals of married life and the ideals of family life, and that those are ideals and they don't happen always on this world, as we know. And oftentimes people marry the exact wrong person for them. You can't regret it, especially when you have, as I do and as Andre does, beautiful children from that marriage. And as Chuck does. you know, and I was telling Andre that my mother was the only one in my nuclear family that didn't marry the wrong person the first time. And unfortunately, most of us got it right the second time. I think my brother was married three times. And I have friends who have been married five times, you know. God bless them for keep trying. Yeah.
practice, man.
But, time to charm.
I told Andre that one thing that would have been really helpful for me as a young person would have been a serious education about marriage and family life and what it meant and what it means. And I pointed out last week that Jesus, when he spent the day alone in the hills with John Mark, a teenager who followed the apostles around and was their faithful eyes and ears and was able to fly below the radar, and such a hero in my eyes, John Mark is. I just love John Mark and the whole Mark family. And I think about all that he did and how much he loved Jesus. And this, we all love the story of One Day Alone in the Hills with God, where Jesus is getting ready to go and spend some serious time in contemplation and meditation and away from everything. And John Mark makes bold to bring a basket, and he won't let it go until the master consents to take him with. And it's such a touching story. And so what did Jesus talk about? He talked about, to this young man, he talked about family life. And he talked about, he reflected on this young man's own upbringing and how important that was for his entire, even his whole life and even his afterlife. Yeah. And he talked about the importance of what it means to be a mother and what it means to be a father and how important. And he mentions a home where love reigns and wisdom rules. And I thought just recently, I thought, well, that's a great thing to say to a married couple, a great blessing. May your home always be a home where love reigns and wisdom rules.
Yeah.
But, you know, these teachings would have been tremendously valuable to me prior to choosing a life mate. And I did it way too young. I was just 18. Yeah, I don't think an 18-year-old is ready to make that decision. And certainly my mother and father tried to tell me that. But to no avail.
Well, it definitely wisened you.
It did.
Definitely wisened you, you know. It definitely gave you chops. You know, the only thing worse is to never have done it. And I look at some of the people who have, you know, chosen not to, and there may be good reasons, but I wouldn't trade the experience of a bad marriage for no experience at all.
Just never would. Yeah.
You know what? Yeah, and Socrates knew the wisdom of that, because he said in his famous dictum, he said, you know, a good marriage will make a man happy. A bad marriage will make him a philosopher.
He was a wise man, wasn't he?
with a wit as well.
With a wit. Well, you know, and there's something that's very important in any marriage, and that is a sense of humor and an ability to laugh at yourselves. And though I didn't marry well the first time, I married very well the second time. And
yes, you did. I have to concur. I would have married that man, too. He's a good guy.
One of the most
important
things. It's
a
great cook, and he has a great sense of humor. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I love that. And, you know, just a little story. When we went to get Mei Li, when we had been married 13 years, when we went to adopt Mei Li in China, and the whole year prior to going to China, we went through a study, what they called a home study, and a psychologist interviewed me and interviewed Glenn and interviewed me and Glenn and interviewed Nathan and interviewed Jean and then interviewed all four of us together and compiled quite a document. And they did a background check. And, I mean, the Chinese are very serious about, you know, their children. And you have to pass muster for them to give you a child. It's just not an easy thing. And, of course, we were fine with it. But Carol was the name of our caseworker, and she told me when she was interviewing me, she said, I asked Glenn this question, and she said, I want to tell you what he said. And I said, okay. She said, I asked him if you two have ever gotten into a serious fight. And she said, he thought for a moment and said, yes, once. And Carol said to him, well, what was it about? He said, Paula said that Elvis Costello is a punk rocker. And I said, no, he's not. And that was the serious.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Paula said Elvis Costello is a punk rocker. He takes his rock and roll music very seriously.
Well, Diana Krall would never have married a punk rocker. That's for sure.
So true. So, yeah. But that's, you know, as long as you can laugh and have a sense of humor about this world and see the humor in it. Part of the problem is we all take ourselves too seriously, I think. So, anyway, and it's difficult, these challenges of mothers and fathers and the dynamics of male-female relationships. Had we had an Adam and Eve here to show us how it's done, it would have been a completely different story. But we have to figure it out on our own.
The point about even a bad marriage being better than no marriage is kind of reflected in this one. This one part of the book where they talk about the on the Mansion Worlds, you know, the training that we received there, and they comment that what do they say, mortals reach the Mansion Worlds without having benefited particularly from the disciplines derived from fairly average sex relations on their native spheres. Anyway, this is 45, paper 45, section 6, part 3. Anyway, I could just maybe read maybe about half of this paragraph to get a sense of it, because I think it's important in terms of what we're talking about, and even our own experiences, where they might have seemed like disasters, and maybe they were, but nonetheless, we learn from those experiences, right?
Yeah.
So here they say that on the seven mansion worlds, ascending mortals are afforded ample opportunities for compensating any and all experiential deprivations suffered on their worlds of origin, whether due to inheritance, environment, or unfortunate premature termination of the career in the flesh. Boy, how many times does that happen? This is in every sense true, except in the mortal sex life and its attendant adjustments. Thousands, correct me if they say thousands, about millions.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thousands of mortals reach the mansion worlds without having benefited particularly from the disciplines derived from fairly average sex relations on their native spheres. The mansion world experience can provide little opportunity for compensating these very personal deprivations. Sex experience in a physical sense is past for these ascenders, but in close association with the material sons and daughters, both individually and as members of their families, these sex-deficient mortals are enabled to compensate the social, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual aspects of their deficiency. Thus are all those humans whom circumstances or bad judgment deprived of the benefits of advantageous sex association on the evolutionary worlds, here on the system capitals afforded full opportunity to acquire these essential mortal experiences in close and loving association with the supernal Adamic sex creatures of permanent residence on the system capitals. I don't know, there's just so much wrapped up in that. But the suggestion here that our relationships, marriages or whatever they turn out to be, definitely are a part of our, what they say, social, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual growth. And
yeah,
all of those can be affected by, you know, however, to what extent we're able to fulfill the potential of, you know, our relationships and how they can, I guess, discipline our souls in that kind of growth.
And the next paragraph after that one is important,
mm-hmm.
too. This is the very next paragraph. It says, no surviving mortal, midwayer, or seraphim may ascend to paradise, attain the Father, and be mustered into the core of the finality without having passed through that sublime experience of achieving parental relationship to an evolving child of the worlds of some or of the world or some other experience analogous and equivalent thereto. The relationship of child and parent is fundamental to the essential concept of the universal Father and his universe children. Therefore, does such an experience become indispensable to the experiential training of all ascenders? I mean, they couldn't be more clear, could they? This is a required
uh-huh.
experience. It's essential.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be the norm that people opt out of it. It should be only in rare cases do they opt out of this experience.
Well, but a lot of people would love to have that experience, but just haven't.
And just can't.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. The right person hasn't come along or something. Who knows? I mean,
yeah.
It's not an easy thing to make that happen. You know,
no.
We all remember from our younger years, you know, sometimes just grab the opportunity that comes along and then maybe there's some kind of inherent intuitive wisdom in that, just because at least that's going to get this experience going, even if the relationship doesn't last, ultimately. I don't know. That's a tough one. But, you know, the idea is better to have had it, you know, have had marriage and no marriage at all. I don't know. I think that's kind of verified by what they're saying here, in a sense. You know, this idea of disciplines, how do they put that? Yeah, the disciplines derived from fairly average sex relationships. So, I mean, I think even fairly average. That's an interesting
fairly
thing.
Average.
Fairly average.
Average.
Yeah. But even that's going to put us through experiences that have, you know.
So let me ask you this, you guys. Do you think we'll all do a stint with the Adams and the Eves having come from this planet?
You know, I don't know about whether we'll have to do that. I mean, if we've, you know, been in a reasonably normal marriage that way. But in terms of all the aberrations of intellect that they talk about that need to be remediated on the second mansion world, I would say there are a lot of those kinds of intimacy issues that if we were in, you know, a difficult relationship or whatever, a lot of that will be remedied there. I've learned to fall in love with the mind planners. I'm going to need a lot of work with the mind planners.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
okay, so give us a recap of the mind planners, Andre.
Aren't they the psychologists of the first heaven or something?
They are the psychologists of the first heaven. Exactly right, Chuck.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So,
the psychologists of the first heaven. Wow. Good one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's where they're based. So they'll be starting to work with us already on Mansonia 1, where they say we deal with all kinds of, you know, material and physical deficiencies, which is kind of interesting because that's how they phrase it. But you can't imagine that doesn't have to do, you know, also with mental deficiencies, but that they categorize those differently and almost as though on the second Mansonia, once those purely physical deficiency type things have been dealt with. Now you're dealing with more purely mental ones. It's an interesting idea.
Is that where the vestigial traits come in?
You know, certainly the vestigial traits, I think they're going to be dealing with that all the way along. And if we still have anything left before fusion, you know, they'll be dealing with it. I think the last vestigial traits they talk about are finally eradicated on the seventh Mansonia. So it seems to me that some of those things can be a little persistent, even if we get over them overtly. Mm. I'll bet they can sneak up on us. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I'll give you an example. I did not want to get up out of bed this morning after 8 o'clock. I did get up. I did my meditation. I went through and I had my time with God. And when that was over, I rolled over on my pillow, turned on NPR and listened to the news for an hour because I just felt I needed that this morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, is that, you know, would it have done me a bit better to maybe go out for a run, which I used to do, or, you know, take some more positive construct? You know, I could be a little more disciplined in my life than I am. Let's put it that way.
Well, and also let's just face the fact that when you get into your 60s, you slow down. There's something about that. And there's something beautiful about that as well. There's something beautiful. Lately, I've heard so many Your Rancho Book readers tell me, well, you know, I'm in my 70s, but inside I still think I'm 20. That's interesting. That's an interesting way to put it. And I completely understand that because it's hard to reconcile the fact with yourself that you just can't do what you used to do. But I want to read.
At the same time, though, can I comment on that quickly? Yeah. At the same time, if you do that thing of transferring your seat of identity to your Marantia soul self, right? That's ever young. We're babes.
Yeah.
You know,
there you go.
In terms of our soul identity. So
you're an infant.
Yeah. So no wonder. I mean, people who feel young at heart all the way to the day they die kind of have that magical feeling that, they know they're just on the beginning of a much, much, much bigger path. So that, I love that when people are like that, you know, when they're just remain young at heart, regardless of what's going on with their body. But I think even that can help you. I mean, that can sort of retune, you know, that thing of transferring the seat of identity. I think within that is the potential for kind of retuning even your physical, you know, how you feel physically and how you relate to your body. If it's kind of more associated with a Marantia feeling of identity, it's kind of, you know, that kind of, it's like they say about the spirit of truth, it's a tonic for health. I think that also kind of works in the same way.
Good point. I absolutely agree. And it, you know, and it's good to be young at heart because you remain ever a learner then and open to youth and what youth has to teach. And, you know, it's important. It's important.
There's always an eagerness associated with that. Whereas
you have to have a sense of humor about it, too.
If you identify too much with your body, you know, your body's going to deteriorate.
It's inevitable.
It's depressing. Depressing downward slide until, oh my God, it's over or whatever. But that's there's no need to think that way.
I think of our pal Crystal, and who once told me, you know, as we were when we were both in our 50s, she said, "I looked in the mirror the other day and said to the universe, this is a joke, right? This is a joke. This is not my body. What have you done with my body? Bring it back." And she's such a dear friend, and we always can find something to just uproariously laugh about. And so I think that's important, especially when you're dealing with the real physical world.
Yeah, so many things. You know, Paula, yeah, I know you had it. Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. Go ahead, Chuck.
Paula, I know you had another point you wanted to make, too. So,
oh, no, that was it. Just the fact when you're young at heart, you can at least maintain your sense of humor about your body growing old, you know, and keep it in perspective. Our buddy Mo likes to say, getting old ain't for sissies. And I relate to that one, too. You know,
that's funny. Now, just thinking back to what you were saying a little bit earlier about the parental experience, you know, whether we get to whether we might be required to have more of that before we go on. But it occurred to me that maybe that might even be something we'd want to do. I mean, the idea of hanging out in Adamic households, taking care of little Adamic kids. I mean, what could be more fun than that? I mean, I don't know. It might be more ordinary than we realized. That, you know, that where we were just reading the next paragraph is also interesting, I think. This is a short one, but it says that the ascending midway creatures, and remember, they were included in that.
Mm-hmm.
The midwayers and the seraphim.
They're ascending
too. Right. The ascending midway creatures and the evolutionary seraphim must pass through this parental experience in association with the material sons and daughters on the system headquarters. So that's how they do it.
Thus do such
non-reproducing ascenders obtain the experience of parenthood by assisting the Jerusalem Adams and Eves in rearing and training their progeny. Can you imagine? I don't know. That just sounds like such a hoot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Robert on the board asked the question, I wonder if being a dog parent begins to qualify since I've never fathered a child. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, that it probably gives you a little boost up. But I've had lots of friends who never had children, and they are completely resigned to the fact that they're going to have to do this on the mansion worlds. But here's the secret, Robert, and here's the little inside joke. Those of us who have done it will be standing in line saying, I'll do it if you don't have anyone else.
right. That's what I'm thinking.
Let me. And Glenn and I used to fight about who would get up and feed the baby, not about you do it, it's your turn. No, it's like, you did it last night, it's my turn.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
that's funny. That's
because
great.
We so enjoyed it, and there is nothing more magical than seeing the purity and the beauty. I see this in pictures of your baby grandson, Chuck. The purity of being. The purity of being there. I mean, just so present, so there. And to hold that in sacred trust for the father. It's like, you know, I read last week from that day in the hills with John Mark, where he said, you know, how important that is. And that, you know, he said, do you not understand that men and women participate with God and that they bring into creation beings that have the potential of immortal life, you know, eternal life. You're bringing eternal beings into life.
Into existence,
It doesn't matter if you parented them or not. And it's a sacred, sacred responsibility to the Father. And there's just nothing else like it. There's just nothing else like it. And I think that's why they say that, you know, that the quote that you brought up, Chuck, those paragraphs. That's why they say that, because nothing can replace that experience. But, you know, the beauty of that is if we don't get it here, we'll get it there. We will get it, though. It's required.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's launch into our, because the mother family, this part of the reason we got on this is that we're dealing with the mother family and the father family today. I can't recall whether we actually read through all of section two or not, but it probably bears rereading even if we did. So Why don't we do that?
Okay. I'm completely down.
Yeah, oh, here, because this conversation will come up still. Because it's actually a fascinating interweaving with this topic of, you know, this has been going on for, you know, decamillennia. You know, it's been going on for hundreds of thousands of years on our planet with humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
That the family has been evolving through these various stages of mother dominance and then father dominance. And they're trying to lead us to an understanding of the destiny of it and how things could get better. And I think that's some of how we got onto our initial conversation, Paula, was this idea of, boy, you know, it would have been nice to be able to do this a little bit better with a partner who was cooperative, you know, and you've got
an
contrast,
education,
you know.
Yeah,
yeah, you've got right. The contrast in your life because, you know, you had an uncooperative partner to begin with and a cooperative partner. I mean, night and day, basically.
Yeah, night and day.
And I've gotten that experience as well, except not with children, you know.
Right.
It's one thing to be able to do that with children. It's a wonderful experience to have, to experience that kind of harmony in action together is remarkable. But it evolved from primitive beginnings, and Section 2 will take us there. So, any of you guys want to
read? Do you
want
to read it? No, I think you should.
Okay, all right.
Why don't you take it?
I'll jump in.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
The early mother family. The woman's periodic hemorrhage and her further loss of blood at childbirth early suggested blood as the creator of the child, even as the seed of the soul, and gave origin to the blood bond concept of human relationships. In early times, all descent was reckoned in the female line, that being the only part of inheritance which was at all certain. The primitive family, growing out of the instinctive biologic blood bond of mother and child, was inevitably a mother family, and many tribes long held to this arrangement. The mother family was the only possible transition from the stage of group marriage in the horde to the later and improved home life of the polygamous and monogamous father families. The mother family was natural and biologic. The father family is social, economic, and political. The persistence of the mother family among the North American red men is one of the chief reasons why the otherwise progressive Iroquois never became a real state. Under the mother family mores, the wife's mother enjoyed virtually supreme authority in the home. Even the wife's brothers and their sons were more active in family supervision than was the husband. Fathers were often renamed after their own children. The earliest races gave little credit to the father, looking upon the child as coming altogether from the mother. They believed that children resembled the father as a result of association, or that they were marked in this manner because the mother desired them to look like the father. Later on, when the switch came from the mother family to the father family, the father took all credit for the child, and many of the taboos on a pregnant woman were subsequently extended to include her husband. The prospective father ceased work as the time of delivery approached, and at childbirth he went to bed along with the wife, remaining at rest from 3 to 8 days. The wife might arise the next day and engage in hard labor, but the husband remained in bed to receive congratulations.
Oh my God.
This was all a part of the early mores designed to establish the father's right to the child. At first, it was the custom for the man to go to his wife's people. But in later times, after a man had paid or worked worked out the bride price, he could take his wife and children back to his own people. The transition from the mother family to the father family explains the otherwise meaningless prohibitions of some types of cousin marriages, while others of equal kinship are approved. With the passing of the hunter mores, when herding gave man control of the chief food supply, the mother family came to a speedy end. It failed simply because it could not successfully compete with the newer father family. Power lodged with the male relatives of the mother could not compete with power concentrated in the husband father. Woman was not equal to the combined tasks of childbearing and of exercising continuous authority and increasing domestic power. The oncoming of wife stealing and later wife purchase hastened the passing of the mother family. The stupendous change from the mother family to the father family is one of the most radical and complete right-about-face adjustments ever executed by the human race. This change led at once to greater social expression and increased family adventure.
It's such an interesting statement they're making here. And to me, the overall point is they're saying that this is inevitable and that this is what's best. Do you think that? I mean, do you get that from
when,
this?
When you're saying this is what's best, what do you mean exactly?
Well, for social growth and for, you know, for evolution's sake, the father family brought that on apace. And unless I'm misunderstanding, the mother family wouldn't have been able to accomplish the great social changes that needed to happen to create the development of the state and the evolutionary progress of mankind and civilization in general.
Right. Yeah, I think they're saying it was an essential stage. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, I was going to sort of say the same thing. Not that it's, in other places they talk about the family council model of family life. And seem to put that even above one parent or the other having all the authority. But what they're describing here is an evolutionary process. Amazing that how they describe it, too. Like this about phase being such a kind of sudden and radical departure. But, it's best in terms of the evolutionary unfolding of things. But I think going into the future, I mean, particularly with this revelation and its revelation of the mother spirit and this complemental nature of deity. The deity is always almost seems to be complemental, even with the Adams and Eves. It's a complemental relationship. That the family council approach would be maybe more like, the next stage, perhaps. And I don't know. I mean, Claire and I, we were both familiar with the Ranch book, and we read all, these things together and understood this idea of the family council approach, and we tried to implement that. And I think it was very good, where we would just, the whole family sit together and talk about what's going on and what needs to be done. And it wasn't like any one person was lording it over everyone else. So I think there is wisdom in that. It kind of relaxes the paternity, patriarchy thing, that everybody's always talking about. The solution to that is family council.
Well, for me, the issue on Urantia always is that we tend to swing from one extreme to the other. And we have a very, very hard time finding middle ground ever, which is where we need to be, right? But we always overreact to, it seems, to certain problems or certain social issues. Robert on the board just said this might be the funniest statement in all of the 196 papers, quote, the wife might arise the next day and engage in hard labor, but the husband remained in bed to receive congratulations. That struck me as pretty funny, but that's to my point, that we go from one extreme to the other. And I think this is where Revelation looms so large for us. And had we had successful, the first Revelation and the second Revelation been successful, we wouldn't have many of these problems that we have. And I know I'm stating the obvious, but some of these things are so subtle that the guidance that they would have provided us, even for basic things like how men and women get along with each other,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
that they would have modeled for us, and we could have seen that and said, oh, of course, you know, one can't tyrannize the other. We have to learn to get along. Yes, of course, family meetings, family council, Jesus incorporated so many of those techniques, and yet we haven't had the benefit of them until now, because we have this revelation now that tells us what his techniques were. You know, so it's just really interesting mm-hmm. that we've suffered in untold ways simply because we didn't know what to do and there was no way for us to figure it out.
Yeah.
And we're, that's why we're more than a full dispensation behind. And we kind of are like a pinball. We bounce from one extreme to the other. But for me, there's great comfort in the knowledge that, you know, the pendulum has to swing both ways before it finds the middle.
Yeah.
And
here's
Marvin.
By the way, Marvin is with us.
Hi, Marvin.
Morning, Marvin.
You made it.
Hi, guys.
Hi, there you are.
Nice to hear you.
Are you wanting to participate or just listen?
I think I'll just listen. I'll tell you what. Keep me in the open queue, and I'll stay muted if I have something that I feel I just cannot not share. I'll make myself known. But,
we all know how that is, Marvin.
wonderful to hear you guys. And just you for too. Anyone who's listening, you know, I've got a bit of a head chest cold, so kind of functioning at low level here in the background.
Okay.
You know, the beautiful thing about an auditory format is that nobody can tell that you have a cold. Just kidding.
Well, I can.
Yeah. I wish I couldn't tell that I had a cold.
Wouldn't that be nice?
But
well,
as you guys know, I mean, the subject marriage and family and the nature of relationships is real dear to my heart and fundamental to the nature of all reality. So I'm so glad we're focusing here.
Yeah.
I found the
welcome.
I found the quote.
Yeah, good to have you there.
With the family council comment. I think
okay.
Marvin,
cool.
Marvin, you'll probably enjoy this. This is in paper 84. Well, maybe it's in the paper we're reading. I don't know. It's,
we're
going
to get to it.
Anyway, here's a quick preview of what's coming. Just this one paragraph.
Coming
to 84.
Spoiler alert.
spoiler alert. 84:7-29, they say, human society would be greatly improved. I mean, that alone is a pretty strong statement. Human society would be greatly improved if the civilized races would more generally return to the family council practices of the Andites. They did not maintain the patriarchal or autocratic form of family government. They were very brotherly and associative, freely and frankly discussing every proposal and regulation of a family nature. They were ideally fraternal in all their family government. Ideally fraternal, that means brotherly and sisterly,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In an ideal family, filial and parental affection are both augmented by fraternal devotion. And that one sentence is one that I remember Claire and I talked about a lot, you know, how to implement that and what that really means, because neither of us had grown up in a family like that. But the idea, so there's fraternal, filial, and parental qualities of relationship, you know, and to pay attention to all three, but particularly this idea that now what's filial? That's the love of a child for a parent, right? Is that what that word means?
That's a good
parental
question.
Parental is the love of a parent for a child, and paternal is the love of siblings for each other. Let me just...
It says, of a due from a son or daughter, a display of filial affection. So maybe it's
from
a natural...
Yeah, right. I think it's the love of the child for its parent.
Right,
or at least
right.
They say,
it's a natural kind of affection. It goes without saying almost that the child will have that affection.
From a son or daughter. Yeah, I just looked that up too. Right. Dutiful, devoted, respectful, affectionate, all of those. So anyway, I just think that's really, really interesting how they point out those three types of relationship and how they're all important. And if you can keep them in balance, then you're going to have a much healthier kind of family dynamic. And also, I'm sure for the kids growing up, it's much better as well. And it seems like there are descriptions, you know, when Jesus had to take over the family after Joseph died. I think there's language in there, too, describing how Jesus implemented a family council approach to their family life. Even though he wasn't the biological father of the children, he wasn't literally married to Mary, he was still Mary's partner, parental partner. He played the father role. He took over the father's role in that family. And I believe they, I don't know, I'd have to go and look, but I think they talk about their family practices, you know, how they got through their situations, that they had rules and things, and they all worked it out, and everybody's, you know, they talk about things and come to agreements.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is a very civilized thing to do. You know, they're saying that human society would be greatly improved, you know.
Yeah.
You would do this.
Sure.
You know, because it sets a standard for how to relate and how to, you know, cooperate. It's a very cooperative type of dynamic as opposed to somebody just, like, you know, autocratically, you know.
Well, it's the foundation for democracy as opposed to autocracy, as you're pointing out.
Right.
You know, if you have an autocratic model, you know, in an overly patriarchal family, I mean, there's nothing wrong with you know, patriarchy as an evolutionary form, especially as the patriarch is enlightened to understand that he is with an equal partner. And eventually that evolves to the equal partnership model that is clearly what obtains the closer and closer we get to light and life. It certainly doesn't have to take as long as light and life to get there. But what I'm suggesting is, here we are, you know, we still have people that practice that authoritarian patriarchal model. And, you know, people have I think rightly projected that, you know, this was part of what was going on in Nazi Germany, in, you know, the German family models of the time. And it just makes it that much easier to accept an autocrat when they come along. And it's clear that, you know, not to disparage, you know, Bible-based Christianity, but fundamentalist Christianity does emphasize the father family and still does not elevate woman to the status of a man. And likewise with Islam, you know, and when you have that obtaining in culture, then I think you're setting up the culture to predispose itself to accept the forms that are literally familiar to people. And that's why we need to modify our families. We need to educate our families to become more democratic, but in a wise way. Paula has suggested a number of times, you know, I mean, ahead of the call, one of the things we talked about that we didn't recap was, you know, parental education, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
You have to get education to have a hunting license, to get a fishing license.
Yeah.
You need a little bit of education to get that, to get a driver's license.
Yeah.
Okay? You need nothing except a blood test to get a marriage license.
Right.
Really?
And how much more consequential is that to all of civilization?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to be coming up to some more interesting things here. But one of them is the complemental relationship between men and women. You know, it's not the evening or making them the same that's the point here. I think it's the honoring the difference. Like the mother and the father have different roles in the family. And to honor both so they can both be fulfilled. You know, so you have, you know, fatherly fathers and motherly mothers, you know, and
mm-hmm.
manly men and womanly women.
And it's okay to be those things. And, you know, we talk about Jesus. He was the epitome of balance and integration. He had all, you know, he was integrated. He had mother, father, and child. He took in the whole, the totality of human experience. And he brought that to this world. He bestowed that mm-hmm. upon this world. The balance, the perfect symmetry of a personality was Jesus. And this is what he said, and I just want to share this because it relates to what the conversation we're having, and it's so important. He says this to a man who's abusing his wife in public. And you guys all know this story. It's from the Jesus Papers. It's called Embarking at Tarentum. It's from a time when his private ministry, not his public ministry, this was before his baptism in the Jordan. And he says to this man, you know, the story is he taps him on the shoulder and stops him from abusing her further and then says, what is it that could cause this, you know? And the man kind of comes back to his senses. He snaps back to his senses and realizes, you know, he shouldn't have done it, but she irritates him, you know? And Jesus says to him in parting, he says this, he says, my brother, always remember that man has no rightful authority over woman unless the woman has willingly and voluntarily given him such authority. Your wife has engaged to go through life with you, to help you fight its battles, and to assume the far greater share of the burden of bearing and rearing your children. And in return for this special service, it is only fair that she receive from you that special protection which man can give to woman as the partner who must carry, bear, and nurture the children. The loving care and consideration which a man is willing to bestow upon his wife and their children are the measure of that man's attainment of the higher levels of creative and spiritual self-consciousness. Do you not know that men and women are partners with God in that they cooperate to create beings who grow to possess themselves of the potential of immortal souls? The Father in heaven treats the spirit mother, the children of the universe, as one equal to himself. It is godlike to share your life and all that relates thereto on equal terms with the mother partner who so fully shares with you that divine experience of reproducing yourselves in the lives of your children. If you can only love your children as God loves you, you will love and cherish your wife as the Father in heaven honors and exalts the infinite spirit, the mother of all the spirit children of a vast universe. I said that statement he made came from the time he was with John Mark, but it didn't. It comes from here, where he said, do you not know that men and women are partners with God and that they cooperate to create beings who grow up to possess themselves with the potential of immortal souls?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, this is so beautiful because it speaks to that balance of male-female partnership, what each one provides to the other, and why both are so important and so vital to humanity. And I love that he begins with, you know, always remember that man has no rightful authority over woman unless the woman has willingly and voluntarily given him such authority. You know, I've heard people, even your Rancho Book readers, assert that the woman should always defer to the man in all decisions. Are you
goodness.
Kidding me?
Goodness.
You've got to be kidding.
Good luck with that. Good luck
with
that.
No, there's yeah, especially with your Rancho women.
Well, see, you missed out on the complimentary viewpoint.
Well, right.
Viewpoint, yeah, which gives you sort of like that 3D vision.
Absolutely.
This thing about Jesus, I mean, there are several, I'm just looking here on, just did a quick search, and they refer to him as being manly many times, or several times. You know, they say he was simple, manly, honest, and fearless. And after his first appearance in the temple, they said, never had they observed him so manly and decisive, so authoritative. But what's interesting to me about that is how that comes up in the Beatitudes. And I think this is just maybe worth reading to kind of fill in the picture a little bit about this complemental difference between men and women. The number one is, happy are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And then the midwives comment on that. They say that so-called common sense, or the best of logic, would never suggest that happiness could be derived from mourning. But Jesus did not refer to outward or ostentatious mourning. He alluded to an emotional attitude of tender-heartedness. It is a great error to teach boys and young men that it is unmanly to show tenderness or otherwise to give evidence of emotional feeling or physical suffering. Sympathy is a worthy attitude of the male as well as the female. It is not necessary to be calloused in order to be manly. This is the wrong way to create courageous men. The world's great men have not been afraid to mourn. Moses, the mourner, was a greater man than either Samson or Goliath. Moses was a superb leader, but he was also a man of meekness. Being sensitive and responsive to human need creates genuine and lasting happiness, while such kindly attitudes safeguard the soul from the destructive influences of anger, hate, and suspicion. Mm. Anyway, I really like that.
Oh, yeah, me too. I'm so glad you read that one, because that one came to my mind, too. That those are important qualities, and every human being has a mother and a father. They wouldn't be here if they didn't. They have a mother and a father. And if they're lucky, they have been influenced by both.
Yeah.
And they have picked up qualities and traits of both, not
but
just
that doesn't
one.
That doesn't make us androgynous, though.
No.
No, it doesn't. No, I mean, that. In fact, quite the opposite. The fact that you have, you know, both examples, you know, gives you that variety to pick and choose from. But I really had a revelation in a conversation I was privileged to have with our villa last night. You know, we hung on after the UUI Cafe a little while, and our villa shared something really quite remarkable that is actually obvious in hindsight, but doesn't occur in thinking. You know, at least it didn't occur to me in my thinking in terms of how children respond to single parenting. And she made this statement. She said, you know, children that are single parented, I won't say always, but, you know, feel abandoned. Very often feel abandoned. In fact, maybe most of the time. And there's this idea that, you know, there's the expectation on the part of the single parent that, well, I can do it alone. You know, this other parent was a ne'er-do-well anyway, or was not a willing partner, or fill in the blank. Doesn't matter. From the perspective of the single parent, since they are covering both spaces, it's very easy for them to forget that from the standpoint of the child, they're quite well aware that they have just one parent. And that the other parent that they were supposed to have, whether lost through death, whether lost through divorce, whether lost through any other means,
abandonment
period,
yeah,
feel abandoned. And I thought that was a brilliant insight. I don't know what you think about that, but to me that speaks to our times. Because we're not just dealing with the mother family and the father family. We're dealing with, very often, a lot of single parenting situations these days.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of fatherless families.
A lot of fatherless families.
But even some motherless families, you know,
right.
In the case where, you know, it's a minority, but there are mothers that abandon their children as well. And in much fewer numbers, but it happens. And it's a very, to me, it was a very insightful comment. And, I don't know what you think about that. There is the one statement in the Arantia book that really, really, to me, tacitly corroborates that. And that's in paper 72. And it's very often overlooked by Arantia book readers. But it's quite, quite radical. From the standpoint of our current civilization, and I'll see if I can find this for you in a moment here.
But I think there's a lot of truth in that insight, though, without doubt. And the child growing up in a single parent family is going to have friends that have both their parents in their homes, and they're going to see that and experience that, and then go home to their own home and realize that there's something
they don't have it, right?
Yeah, that compare and contrast is right there.
That can't be easy.
Interestingly, too, there's also the idea that a strong father figure can be a grandfather or an uncle. Or an older brother, although, you know, if he didn't have a father, that would put him at a deficit for sure. But a lot of, you know, we have two instances where a president has been raised by a mother and gone on to be the president of the United States. So that's an interesting, you know, but in both instances, both of those men had strong grandfathers in their lives. And I think personally that it's very, very important for young men, especially, to have a father in their life, especially when they get to puberty and they start to, you know, develop as men. They have to have a strong father figure in their lives. It's just essential. It's so important. And I remember a talk that we had at the summer study session several years back, where Dan Glaser went on about how detrimental it is to young men to not have, you know, and what a crisis it is when you have not only just one family that doesn't have a father, when you have whole pockets of fatherless families, like you do often in poor communities, and how detrimental that is in every way. You know, he was trying to point it out that the research, you know, he was trying to point out the case studies they've done and the research they've done that just shows how detrimental it is not only to the child but even to society, because the young man so often turns to crime and gets involved with gangs.
Rites of passage. You know, the culture is losing its rites of passage, and a lot of that has to do with the male-female bonding as the basis for the family.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, go ahead, Andre, and then I'll share what Perry said on the board, because I think it's important.
All right. Well, what I wanted to share was this quote from 72.3.3, where, you know, it's buried in there, so it's easy to overlook. The average number of children in each family is 5, talking about government on a neighboring planet, and they are under the full control of their parents, or in case of the demise of one or both, under that of the guardians designated by the parental courts. And then it goes on and says it's a great honor for any family to be awarded the guardian of a full orphan. Competitive examinations are held among the parents, and the orphan is awarded to the home of those displaying the best parental qualifications. This is what people miss. In case of the demise of one or both, they do not regard as a single parent family as sufficient parenting, and they will award, they consider that child already an orphan.
Wow, that's interesting.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
And so they have
it's
a
very
deep
often
understanding
missed.
Of it.
Yeah.
And also in that very quote, Andre, is the other thought that I was expressing earlier when Robert made his comment, and that is, what an honor. we those of us who have done it will be standing in line saying, I'll do it. Let me. Because it is just such a splendid experience. There's just nothing else like it. To be able to have an effect on the future of a human being and to be able to be there to help them and guide them and love them and provide for them. It's an honor and a privilege, not a duty.
Well,
you know?
there's another aspect to that too that sort of goes along with what you're saying, Paul. This is a detail in something we just read a few minutes ago in 45:6-4, but it kind of jumped out at me this time in a way that I never noticed before, where they're talking about how, you know, no mortal midway or seraphim may ascend to paradise and attain the Father, be mustered into the core of finality, without having, and this is the part that caught me, without having passed through that sublime experience of achieving parental relationship to an evolving child of the world or some other analogous experience, but the idea of achieving parental relationship. So it's not enough to just plop somebody down at the same table with a kid and call it parental relationship. You know,
right.
There's an achievement involved in that. And that's what I think is sort of the, you know, part of the key to understanding the significance of being a parent, that it is. It's like, I don't know, a graduate course in life beyond any, you know, and it involves the achievement of appropriate attitudes and appropriate involvement with the child and actually having a real relationship. You know, because that, you know, I don't know. I mean, with a lot of families, I'm not trying to generalize, but there can be both parents present and the kids all grow up. But the kids never really had a real relationship with either of their parents, even through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe to some extent, but they seem to be pointing to something more here. You know, the achievement of parental relationship. It's not just something that happens. It's not something that just happens automatically by being in the same
space. It's not biology. Yeah. It's a thing achieved.
Right.
And it's like there's a great quote that says, you know, parenthood is a lifelong responsibility, which the wise child comes to recognize and appreciate. And, you know, anybody who's been a parent knows that their responsibility goes on. And you never quit caring or worrying or hoping or working toward their welfare, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And to the degree that they need you less and less, you graciously let go. And that's a hard thing for parents to do. And there comes a point, I think, in every child's life, and it usually happens when they're teenagers, where they literally push you away. And I have come to believe that this is necessary because they realize how hard it is for you to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to develop their own identity in the world. And sometimes it can be very painful to the parent. It's like, you hate me, you know? But no, it's not that. It's proactive on their part. They have to push off from you so that they can find themselves. And if you've done your work well, they'll come back, right? They'll come back to you and with a new respect. That, you know, they realize that, you know, in retrospect, what all you tried to do for them. And here's the comment that Perry made on the board that I just wanted to share. She said, I would dare to say that the male learns from the outside in while the female learns more from the inside out. And this is why, you know, she said my comment was in relation to the need for young men to have a worthy male influence. It's almost impossible for a woman to understand that about a man and a man to understand that about a woman, because that's the fundamental difference, one of them, right there. And,
well, you know,
and Paul, so,
describe that, because you're right, they don't understand that. What do you mean, what do you mean learning from the inside out for a woman?
Okay.
I actually have a thought, Marvin, related to this.
Okay. I think it's just a fundamental difference. When you look at women, all of our parts are on the inside. All of our biological parts are on the inside. Males are, all of them are on the outside. A woman, just the very act of reproduction is an act of allowing someone inside of her. And it's an act of submission. The very act is an act of submission. And it's very, most often I will say, a woman already has to be in love before she allows that to happen. And she naturally takes it very seriously. Whereas I would think, in my experience, men don't take it as seriously as women do.
Men who are not spiritually awake.
Yeah, true. And that's certainly true in young people, and that's where so much of the activity happens on a regular basis. But if women could just understand that fundamental difference, that they are, you know, submitting, and it's an act of submission on their part, and that they have to be very careful about that and very discriminatory about that. And men have to understand that that very thing is very difficult for her, and she already has a strong emotion toward him, or it wouldn't happen. And so, you know, I think in general, humanity needs to take sex much more seriously, the consequences of it. Not in pregnancy is just one of the consequences. There
you know,
are much more consequences to the woman emotionally and to the man, both, for engaging in that kind of intimacy. And it is an internal and external thing, I think. And
well,
something we need to get a hold of, fundamentally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to add one thought here, and I think Perry's insight and what you just shared, Paul, is very profound. I'll share a story, and then I'll share a little theological perspective from the UB. The story is I had a friend, this is many years ago, probably 40 years ago, and I used to commute to a work site with her. We both worked at the same hospital, and she was an African-American woman. And we had these great conversations, and one time we were talking about the differences between men and women, which was a common subject for us. And I can't remember who made which observation, but one of us made the observation that if it weren't for men, the continent of North America would not have been discovered and pioneered. That it's men that have the pushing, initiating,
the
driving energy to explore unknown regions and forage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the other one of us made the observation that if it weren't for women, all of what men had initiated would have fallen apart within the first generation.
Yeah.
It was women that consolidated and grew and created something lasting and valuable out of that initiating activity of the male. And to me that's related to a very interesting way they use the words, the variations of the word creator in the Urantia book. They associate the word creator with the father. And they associate the term co-creative with the eternal son. And the Michael sons are both creators and, in a sense, co-creators.
Hmm.
But they use the word for the mother spirit. They don't use the word creative or co-creative or creator. They use the word creative. The mother spirit is a creative being. She is the fundamental act of creation, whereas the father presence is the initiator, in a sense. And a third really interesting sort of piece of language is that the product of that creator and creative process is a creature, created being. So the father is a creator being. The eternal son is both a creature, a created being, and a co-creator, and the mother spirit and the infinite spirit is a creative being. And if I'm remembering correctly, neither the son, well, I can't remember. I'm pretty sure that the infinite spirit, when she creates her offspring, does it in association with the father in some fashion. So that the prerogative to create persons in some fashion always remains a derivative of the father's function, to create the creator act. But the creative presence, which is absolutely necessary, is in the spirit. So there's all that that's really pretty interesting that really relates to what I think Perry shared as well in an interesting way.
Yeah. There's so many insights to be gained from just looking at that one thought, that one idea, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That lead to understanding of each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think of time and place. That's one of my favorite things to think about. Michael is time. We live in a dual origin universe. Michael is time. Mother is space. Time and place.
Hmm.
Men are more time. Women are more place. And both are fundamental. And, you know, women tend to focus on place. That's why we tend to be the homemakers, right? And we read that last week, too. You know, he wandered in the cave and said, wow, it's nice in here. I think I'll hang out. Chuck made the comment, it smells good, too. So what's cooking? And, yeah. It's just such a natural, fundamental thing that it's in us. And viva la difference, it's what makes all the difference. And it should be celebrated and honored and loved and brought out, encouraged. And I think, you know, I think we're going through some definite changes socially where, you know, I feel sorry for men because I feel like they are displaced in all of these social changes. And their roles have been lost to a large degree. And that makes me sad because they are so important, just as women are, you know.
I came across an interesting quote that kind of illustrates that. This is from a guy named Abdul Baha. He was a Baha'i.
Abdul Baha,
you know about him. Anyway, he
was
Baha'u'llah's
son.
I was just looking him up here online. Anyway, he's quoted as saying that the world of humanity is possessed of two wings, the male and the female. So long as these two wings are not equivalent in strength, the bird will not fly.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty insightful.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Kind of along the lines of what we're talking about.
Yeah, when we engage for in a competition for dominance, that's we all lose. Because, you know, and I've seen many marriages wrecked because of that competitive idea. Like, you know, we have to prove one is better than the other, or one is unnecessary, or one is necessary. Or, you know, they both are. They're both essential, vital. They both create a whole concept that you couldn't achieve any other way. And I think that's what we've been saying for the last, you know, 45 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's read section 3, the family under father dominance, and see what insights we can glean from that. Chuck, would you like to read that?
Sure, I'd love to. Okay. The family under father dominance. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. It may be that the instinct of motherhood led woman into marriage, but it was man's superior strength, together with the influence of the mores, that virtually compelled her to remain in wedlock. Pastoral living tended to create a new system of mores, the patriarchal type of family life. So by pastoral, they mean agricultural?
No.
As opposed to, huh?
The herder.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's pastoral? Okay, I'm glad I asked.
Yeah, agricultural comes after that.
Okay. All right, so pastoral living tended to create a new system of mores, the patriarchal type of family life. And the basis of family unity under the herder, there you go, and early agricultural mores was the unquestioned and arbitrary authority of the father. All society, whether national or familial, passed through. Oh, sorry.
No worries.
What's happening? My phone's blowing up here. I got a decline, sorry. Let's see.
All society.
The scant courtesy paid womankind during the Old Testament era is a true reflection of the mores of the herdsmen. The Hebrew patriarchs were all herdsmen, as is witnessed by the saying, "The Lord is my shepherd." But man was no more to blame for his low opinion of woman during past ages than was woman herself. She failed to get social recognition during primitive times because she did not function in an emergency. She was not a spectacular or crisis hero. Maternity was a distinct disability in the existence struggle. Mother love handicapped women in the tribal defense. Primitive women also unintentionally created their dependence on the male by their admiration and applause for his pugnacity and virility. This exaltation of the warrior elevated the male ego, while it equally depressed that of the female and made her more dependent. A military uniform still mightily stirs the feminine emotions. Interesting. And all, but there's many other kinds of uniforms nowadays, too. Among the more advanced races, women are not so large or so strong as men. Women, being the weaker, therefore became the more tactful. Tactful.
Tactful,
right. She early learned to trade upon her sex charms. She became more alert and conservative than man. More alert and conservative than man. Like she's keeping her eye on things, though slightly less profound. Man was woman's superior on the battlefield and in the hunt, but at home, woman has usually outgeneraled even the most primitive of men. The herdsman looked to his flocks for sustenance, but throughout these pastoral ages, woman must still provide the vegetable food. Primitive man shunned the soil. It was altogether too peaceful, too unadventurous. There was also an old superstition that women could raise better plants. They were mothers. In many backward tribes today, the men cook the meat, the women the vegetables. And when the primitive tribes of Australia are on the march, the women never attack game, while a man would not stoop to dig a root. Woman has always had to work, at least right up to modern times. The female has been a real producer. Man has usually chosen the easier path, and this inequality has existed throughout the entire history of the human race. Woman has always been the burden bearer, carrying the family property and tending the children, thus leaving the man's hands free for fighting or hunting. Woman's first liberation came when man consented to till the soil, consented to do what had theretofore been regarded as woman's work. It was a great step forward when male captives were no longer killed, but were enslaved as agriculturists. Anyway, this brought about the liberation of women so that she could devote more time to homemaking and child culture. Well, the provision of milk for the young led to earlier weaning of babies, hence to the bearing of more children by the mothers, thus relieved of their sometimes temporary barrenness, while the use of cow's milk and goat's milk greatly reduced infant mortality. Before the herding stage of society, mothers used to nurse their babies until they were 4 and 5 years old. Well, decreasing primitive warfare greatly lessened the disparity between the division of labor based on sex. But women still had to do the real work while men did picket duty. That's a funny sentence. Women still had to do the real work while men did picket duty. No camp or village could be left unguarded, day or night. But even this task was alleviated by the domestication of the dog. Yay, dogs. In general, the coming of agriculture has enhanced woman's prestige and social standing. At least this was true up to the time man himself turned agriculturalist. And as soon as man addressed himself to the tilling of the soil, there immediately ensued great improvement in methods of agriculture, extending on down through successive generations. In hunting and war, man had learned the value of organization, and he introduced these techniques into industry, and later, when taking over much of woman's work, greatly improved on her methods of labor. Oh, man.
Well, you know, and to me, the interesting thing is that in the meantime, all of this she did while also tending to children, which
right, exactly.
takes her immediate focus every time. You know, if she's a good mother, she'll drop everything she's doing to meet the needs of her children. And I remember one of the classes I took in high school was about child culture and child psychology. And one of the things that they told us was that babies thrive as long as they are close to their mothers. And that even in cultures where mothers still have to work and they carry their young child on their back while they till the soil or work in the fields, that child is happier than a child who is left behind while the mother goes and does that stuff. So that, you know, they pointed out that a child, a baby, thrives by being close to its mother and by being touched and being in the presence of its parents, but especially its mother. And so, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, that the divisions were never such that child rearing was honored in the way that Jesus asked the man in Tarentum to honor it, because it is such a pervasive responsibility and such an immediate responsibility. And so that I think, again, Adam and Eve would have helped us sort that out. They would have shown us how to do that. But I'm also struck by the fact that adventurous man, you know, he's such an adventurer. And I love that. He's the innovator, the one that you were saying, the creator, you know, that goes out and bravely dares to find a new way or a better way. So vitally important. The woman may come along and institute that and make that a part of the culture. But the man is the one who adventurously goes out and creates it and does it. We're really so beautifully complemental. Are you guys still there?
Yes.
We are.
Deal with something. I mean, this whole presentation—it's almost. I mean, it's not tongue-in-cheek or anything. I mean, it's serious. But at the same time, there's kind of, you almost have to laugh at some of this. You know, it's so human. All of this is so human. These adjustments and struggles.
Yeah.
And all the pitfalls of gender relationship as they play out into differing circumstances. You just have to kind of roll your eyes at a certain point. But, yeah, it's fascinating, though. In terms
it
of
is fascinating.
Pointing a way forward, you know, where it doesn't have to be like any of these past experiments. We can do a new experiment, right? Uplift potentials in these relationships.
Well, Perry made another comment on the board that's intriguing to me. And, Perry, I invite you to call in and explain this if you like. 646-716-8158. It's only been 13 years. You think I'd remember that number by now. But anyway, she said social disruption results from the spiritualization of the herd mentality. That is a very intriguing statement, Perry, and I would love to hear you expand on that. But I'll throw it out to Chuck and Andre. What do you guys think about that statement? I'm just really intrigued by it.
Well,
social
I'd love
disruption.
To hear you explain it, because
I'm
not exactly sure what it means. I mean, you would expect the spiritualization of the herd mentality to make an improvement. Whatever the social disruption would be, I'm interested in understanding exactly. I mean, it's clear just the transition in the mores always changes social disruption. Anytime the power equations in a society are changing, that causes disruption. So point well taken there. What is being referred to is the fact that anytime you make a change, and even a positive change in terms of spiritualization, then that transition causes disruption. That would be a true statement, I would think.
Yeah, and we just read, Andre, the other night in study group. Andre and I are in a Tuesday night study group that's been going on for decades. And now it's exclusively on Zoom, but we used to have it at Mo Siegel's house every Tuesday night for years and years and years. And we study primarily the Jesus papers. And Jesus made the statement that, he came to bring peace. And I think this is what I gather from Perry's comment. He came to bring peace, but it won't happen, obviously, for a time, because he offered the illustration that in those homes where everybody accepted the gospel, no problem, but in those homes where some didn't accept it, and the gospel being the truth, they said that's what it means. They accepted the truth. They're living by that. Fine, no problem. But in those homes where there's a division of acceptance, then there's going to be problems, even enmity within the family. And so maybe that's what Perry had in mind. But I think Perry's on. Perry, do you want to come on and give us your thoughts on that?
Hi, guys.
Hi, Perry.
Hey. Good morning,
hello.
Perry.
Good to hear your voice.
this particular idea of the herd mentality has been something that I've been working with for many years. My observation is that we are embedded in it to a degree that we have very little awareness of. It runs so many of our subconscious reactions and determines how we behave. Socially, particularly socially. And when we superimpose a spiritual goal upon those subconsciously driven behaviors that are just, you know, they go back to the, as far as I can see, they go back to the Lucifer Rebellion, and were very slightly shifted by Adam and Eve. And so we're really right now in the crux of this struggle, because the world is very hard in a lot of ways. We can see it in all areas of endeavor, education and religious institutions, economics, everything is being radically shifted in this time of our pandemic, which is giving us this opportunity to reevaluate these old patterns. But they're in us, and they rise up. Whether it's the I don't want to take too much time, but I just always go back to the time I spent on a horse-drawn theater caravan, and how the teams pulled the wagons, the horses. And there's such a thing as the lead mare, the herd lead of the herd, and she is the one who governs, and everybody has to be beneath her, and she will not willingly, easily pull with anybody else. There's so many things that if we start to just look at how other species interact, we can see ourselves there. And then try and spiritualize what's going on with our awareness, our intelligence.
Wow. So in a nutshell, can you give us can you define herd mentality from your research and your study? Is that based on the fact that we're mammals? We are a herd. We enjoy being in a herd, obviously. I mean, there's lots of things that characterize that, but in your experience, what does herd mentality mean?
That we're reacting all the time to these subtle signals of whether we're included or we're not included, whether we're high up in the herd or we're on the outskirts. And emotionally, we react to those things, and I think that the epidemic, not just of the virus, but the epidemic of depression and the sense of purposelessness is a testament to that sense of not being included. And again, that what Andre started to talk about in his conversation last night about abandonment, we all feel it. We all feel it on a fundamental level. For me, it goes down to the hormone oxytocin, which has been my specialty over the last 15 years.
Wow. So that's
the belonging hormone.
it's the belonging hormone. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for that. And so the spirituality, if you introduce, like I was pointing out what Jesus said, if you introduce a new spiritual truth that may be counter to what the herd has agreed upon, a collective agreement, then it brings disruption. Is that
absolutely
essentially? Yeah. Okay. Wow. Thank you. Thank you for coming on and sharing that with us.
Okay. I'm having a good time here.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you're welcome to come on and join us anytime you like. And, if you do call in, I would tell our callers, if you want to make a comment, press the 1 key and a little hand goes up on the studio board and we know you'd like to make a comment.
And we really
appreciate that. Yeah, anytime.
Thank you.
You too, Robert.
And poor Marvin with his cold.
Poor Marvin with his cold. Well, God bless you,
darling.
He'll survive. It's so good to hear your voice. Yeah, he'll survive. We know
God
our
bless.
Marvin. He's tough.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to sign off now.
Okay,
sounds
Barry.
Good.
Thank
thanks,
you.
Barry.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for sharing.
Bye.
Yeah, and Robert made a comment, too, that is really important. He said, it struck him, to describe when slavery can be described as progress in that statement where they said it is a great step forward when male captives were no longer killed but enslaved as agriculturalists. And isn't it interesting how the the progress of a past age can be so eschewed in a current age as being barbaric and awful, and we tend to not see some of the benefits that accrue from even, I mean, the Urantia book was very stunning in this way when it goes on about war and the value of war, right?
Mm-hmm.
Having grown up in the 60s, we were all about war had no value. And
well,
then to read that,
it would concur that it has
eye-opening.
Diminishing value.
Right.
And that it doesn't really have value today, that it ought to be eschewed, as should slavery. There's no question. You know, the authors, the revelators aren't calling us back to that. But point you're making is, in the historical context, you know, all of a sudden we're given a sense, you know, at the time, it was a progressive advance. And I think they're talking about early slavery. I don't think they're talking about the idea that we were engaging in it in the 16th century and resurrecting the practice as relatively civilized people. That was somewhat of a backward step.
I agree.
Horrible, I mean,
it
did advance us industrially. It did do that. But boy, the cost of that. It's to do a cost benefit analysis of that would be, aside from being highly controversial, would be fraught with some difficulty in truly understanding both the costs and the benefits and really weighing those. You know, to the slave, there was no benefit to being enslaved. None. You know, the only thing that you could argue at all is that, I don't even want to make that argument. I'm going to just say...
Leave it there. No. There was just no benefit.
I'm going to leave it there because it's just too misunderstandable to...
Yeah.
Especially in our present cultural context, it's a difficult thing to do. I would love in a small quarter to go through and discuss, you know, to really understand that. But I really wonder, I mean, what was a benefit maybe in ancient Rome or before that? You know, you have to really say that in the same way that war has had diminishing returns and increasing deficits through history, slavery has been the same way.
Right. It's just interesting and I think insightful and helpful to view humanity through the lens of their long-distance view, you know?
Mm-hmm.
To view the episodes of history through their long-distance view and to be able to see the progress of the whole, you know, and how each part played a part. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about the Urantia book or the history of papers, is that it gives you that overarching perspective where you can say, okay, well, we're not too far off. We've done some things to each other that have been dreadful and horrible, but this happens on most primitive planets. And as they come from that age of primitiveness into a more enlightened age of brotherhood, they find better ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they're calling us to. They're calling us out of our primitive ways. They're trying to wake us up from our primitive ways. We've been locked into that, and to Perry's point about herd mentality, we've been locked into some primitive ways for an awfully long time, and we haven't been able to shake ourselves free of them. And clearly one of them is one sex tyrannizing over the other, and they call that one out, completely call it out. mm-hmm. that we don't even consider you as being out of barbarism until you stop doing that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then they also give us the perspective, like this very paper we're reading, how these ideas evolved and how that evolution
yeah.
is somewhat natural and mm-hmm. should be, you know, expected. But then you got to let it go. It's just like growing up, you know. You've got to let your childish ways go so that you can grow up into adulthood and, you know, your full stature in your character.
That goes along with a comment they make in paper 82, where they say that all ancient peoples should always be studied and judged in the light of the moral standards of the mores of their own time.
Of that day, right.
Yeah, I think
so
that's such
important.
Such an important reminder, because it's so tempting to look at primitive people and say, oh, man, look at them. They're like, you know, and judge them negatively, when in reality, they, maybe they're the foundation that we're standing on.
They
you know
are.
What I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
even
they were making
we
the best of what they had.
At the time, yeah. They were
yeah.
making the best of what they had at the time. So, you know, it's like the whole thing about, you know, beating up on patriarchy all the time. You know, it's like I have to kind of remember that the men who found themselves in positions of responsibility under the mores of those times had wives. They had mothers. They had daughters. They had families. They had communities. You know, and they, you know, and the better, more righteous men, I'm sure, in those days or times, even as they may continue into the present, feel a sense of responsibility that extends beyond themselves. They're not just self-interested as men necessarily, although they might be in some cases, but, you know, allowing for that possibility, I think, is important. Because like they're saying, you know, the most pugnacious of male conquerors eventually had to go home to his wife. And there's like a whole different scene, you know, if he, assuming he had a wife and family. But anyway, I just think that's an important comment in the book there about judging people in the light of their mores of their own times.
I couldn't agree more. And the book really helps us with that. Right? Because without that, you just say, what is wrong with us? You know, I do that anyway. But it helps you come to an understanding about that, you know, how we are who we are and how we got here from there. And it's so insightful. I just can't think of a better word for it. But here's a quote that always helps me. That's helped me tremendously, and it's from the Jesus Papers. It's from paper 140, and it's midway or commentary, but they say this about Jesus. They say Jesus made, this is 148.3, by the way, Jesus made clear to the three the difference between the requirements of apostleship and discipleship. And even then he did not forbid the exercise of prudence and foresight by the 12. What he preached against was not forethought, but anxiety, worry. He taught the active and alert submission to God's will. In answer to their many questions regarding frugality and thriftiness, he simply called attention to his life as a carpenter, boatmaker, and fisherman, and to his careful organization of the 12. And here's the part that really helps me. He sought to make it clear that the world is not to be regarded as an enemy, that the circumstances of life constitute a divine dispensation working along with the children of God. We're all in a divine dispensation, wherever we happen to find ourselves in this world, and as we play a part in its history and its ongoing evolution. And we're working along with it, doing the best we can with what we've got. And the world is not the enemy, and humanity is not the enemy. None of us are the enemy. You know, we're working along in a dispensation, and it's part of our growth. The beauty, I think the last bastion for humankind, the great threshold for us to cross, is the concept that if we could just work together to solve our problems, whether we're men and women in a family, or states in a country, or countries in the world, if we could just get a grasp on the fact that if we could come together and work together to solve our problems, there's probably not a single problem we couldn't solve.
Yeah.
Mm. We work
Amen.
Together
here's
in the dispensation.
Amen.
What can I say?
Here's an interesting little portrait of what was going on with Jesus and his family, you know, after Joseph's death. Just a paragraph from paper 126 when he's, I think, 15, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, says, this was the year that Jesus rented a considerable piece of land just to the north of their home, which was divided up as a family garden plot. Each of the older children had an individual garden, and they entered into keen competition in their agricultural efforts. The eldest brother spent some time with them, I guess that would be Jesus, with them in the garden each day during the season of vegetable cultivation. As Jesus worked with his younger brothers and sisters in the garden, he many times entertained the wish that they were all located in a farm out in the country where they could enjoy the liberty and freedom of an unhampered life. But they did not find themselves growing up in the country, and Jesus, being a thoroughly practical youth as well as an idealist, intelligently and vigorously attacked his problem just as he found it, and did everything within his power to adjust himself and his family to the realities of their situation and to adapt their condition to the highest possible satisfaction of their individual and collective longings.
That's beautiful, Chuck.
Yeah. Well, and here's a little bit more. I guess just a little bit more. At one time, Jesus faintly hoped that he might be able to gather up sufficient means, provided they could collect the considerable sum of money due his father for work on Herod's palace to warrant undertaking the purchase of a small farm. He had really given serious thought to this plan of moving his family out into the country. But when Herod refused to pay them any of the funds due Joseph, they gave up the ambition of owning a home in the country. As it was, they contrived to enjoy much of the experience of farm life as they now had 3 cows, 4 sheep, a flock of chickens, a donkey, and a dog, in addition to the doves. Even the little tots had their regular duties to perform in the well-regulated scheme of management which characterized the home life of this Nazareth family. That's the little tots had their regular duties.
Even a little
there's so much. There's so much endearment. You know, what I was having a thought while we've been just discussing all this, and it seems like a lot of what we're talking about is getting from meanness to endearment. You know,
it's like
the holding of grudges and resentments, and oh, that's not fair, and
unfair competition.
And that, you know, there's so much that can lead to meanness, even in family life, as I'm sure we've all experienced. So to overcome that with endearment is kind of like where you step back for a minute and you appreciate, you know, have a deeper understanding of people's nature and why they do things, mm-hmm. and their motivations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so like in that section we just read where they're describing this crazy evolution, to put all of that kind of within a container of endearment for the human species, I think it's kind of the spirit of the authors when they talk about these things. You know, they're not laying blame. They're not saying, man, they were so stupid back then. Look at all that bad stuff they did. You know, they don't present it that way. They just do it in kind of a matter of fact way. But it leaves me with a feeling of endearment in spite of all the, you know, whatever, the struggles that humanity has been through. You can't help but have a feeling of endearment for the.
Your quote makes me think of another one that has come to mind a lot lately. And this is one for the pandemic. And this, again, is from Jesus and from the Jesus papers. It's paper 127, section 3, paragraph 14. It says about the family under Jesus after Joseph died. For 4 years, their standard of living had steadily declined. Year by year, they felt the pinch of increasing poverty. By the close of this year, they faced one of the most difficult experiences of all their uphill struggles. James had not yet begun to earn much, and the expenses of a funeral on top of everything else staggered them. But Jesus would only say to his anxious and grieving mother, "Mother Mary, sorrow will not help us. We are all doing our best. A mother's smile, perchance, might even inspire us to do better. Day by day we are strengthened for these tasks by our hope of better days ahead." His sturdy and practical optimism was truly contagious. All the children lived in an atmosphere of anticipation of better times and better things. And this hopeful courage contributed mightily to the development of strong and noble characters in spite of the depressiveness of their poverty. I just think of how, you know, how important that is when he says to his mother, "Perchance your smile will inspire us to do better. Don't show us only your sorrow. Yeah, times are hard, but we need you to be strong here." And so, you know, I say that to all the mothers and fathers out there going through this pandemic. It's not easy. I don't think anybody thought it would be, and it certainly isn't. But your smile and your hope and your courage and your optimism will carry your precious children and your loved ones forward to better days, because better days are coming. Humanity's been through a lot, and we've endured a lot. And we'll get through this, too. Like my grandma used to say, this too will pass.
Oh. She was ahead of her time.
Well, that was a popular poem, too, back then. And I think her generation, of course, think of all they endured. She endured a pandemic. She endured two world wars, a Great Depression, and raised a family through all of that. And this too will pass is from a great poem that was beloved in that generation. So it's one of those words of wisdom that we give each other in hard times, just like Jesus gave to Mary.
My mother had a saying kind of like that. She used to bring this up every once in a while. I mean, from everything she'd been through growing up, the tragedy and trying to survive on the plains of eastern Colorado and all of that. But she used to say, "One stitch upon another, and the largest rent is mended."
Aw, I love that. See, it's interesting. You still remember that, right? The wisdom that we give our children that in hard times is what sticks with them.
One stitch upon another.
One stitch upon another. You know, Jesus said that in another way. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, "Sufficient unto the day are the troubles thereof." You know, give it one day.
Right.
You don't have to worry about what happened yesterday. Or what's going to happen tomorrow. Just take it one day at a time, one breath, one step, whatever, one stitch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what a great group, you guys. Thank you so much. I just so enjoy this study, like all of them. It's such a great study. And
by the way, that comes from Solomon Seal by the English poet Edward Fitzgerald. He recapped and brought forward an ancient Persian adage that was translated forward. Yeah.
This too shall pass.
Which saying?
This too shall pass. The poet wrote a fable called Solomon Seal.
Solomon Seal, okay. Thanks, Andre.
Yeah,
a very wise woman, Aretha Franklin, used to do a worships in California, in Southern California. And my friend told me, she said on the stage one day, "It came to pass." It came true, but it came to pass. And so it's a simple way to look at it. It came to pass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my friends. Well, we'll be back next week and continue the study on marriage and family life. And I guess we'll pick up with woman's status in early society. That should be insightful.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining
us.
It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Yep. Until next week.
Yep.
Bye for now.
We'll be back. Take care. Much love. Bye for now.
Much love. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.